Really?
Okay. So what I thought we'd talk about tonight is some of the current research on addiction, some of the current stuff being done and that's out there that changes it a little bit. I, like a lot of people, I've been around the addiction world since I got involved in this. In fact, it was because of that that I got involved in hypnosis and NLP and the whole nine yards. I was a substance abuse counselor because I was in recovery myself and started doing some work and volunteering and doing a few things. And the next thing you know, I'm becoming a substance abuse counselor. And that kind of led me into going back to school and learning formal hypnosis and NLP. In fact, people have heard my story about the first few times I hypnotized somebody at a treatment center. I just read a book and started doing it. But that goes back to the early to mid-80s when there was no training in this this. And then I took my NLP training and things just kept going. But the current treatment modality of choice, it seems to this day, still is the 12-step programs, the 12-step approach. And, you know, when you look at it from a hypnosis or an NLP standpoint, I think the 12-step model and the hypnosis works. They can work together. Because when the way I look at it, you know, is it, people wonder, you know, is alcoholism and drug addiction and most of these addictions, is it nature or nurture? Is it, you know, almost genetic, or is it a learned behavior? And, you know, the research kind of goes back and forth on that depending on who you talk to and what addiction specifically you're talking about. There's a lot of research on the alcoholism because it's the most abused drug in the world. And what they found is there are certain people, American Indians is one of the biggest, Irish have a tendency to have some of this, where their body does not break down alcohol the same way that people that can drink successfully. And so what that means is they get drunk quicker, they stay drunk longer, and it seems to stay in their system with more effect. And so they don't have the same kind of tolerance toward it. And so there seems to be a genetic portion to it. And then you cash in that with all the nurturing stuff or the, you know, the society, the psychology of it. And now you got a double-edged kind of a double lose-lose situation. And that, in fact, I honestly believe we must always remember the fact that human beings by nature are addictive. If something feels good, changes our mood, we have a tendency to like it and want to do more of it. And for most people, that's fine. They can have a few drinks. It makes them feel goofy and have fun and do some things, and they're fine. Next day, they go to work. They don't really think about it. Same with that's for alcohol. Even social gambling, if there's such a thing. You know, they go to Vegas once a year. They might play a occasional lotto or scratch-off ticket, but there's always that small subset of the population that you know, one is too many and 1,000 is not enough. Once they start, they just can't stop. And so what the 12-step model says is that, you know, it's both and that we have to, you know, that the 12 steps change it. But one of the interesting things, now this is what I wanted to talk about, is some of the research that kind of points out what the 12 steps do, why they work from a brain chemical standpoint. And it's the same reason why, you know, therapy, especially therapy that teaches relaxation techniques, transcendental meditation, hypnosis, any kind of alternative state training, has some of the same things. It changes what they would call the landscape of the neurochemical pathways. And that's what I wanted to talk about. Because when you think about the addictions from the standpoint I look at it, you know, consciously, you know, we only do a few things. It's I use the same model that a lot of hypnotists use. Consciously, we can only do several things. It's where our analytical and rational mind is. It's the part of our mind where our short-term memory is. And it's the part of our mind where our willpower is. And when it comes to addictions, this is very important because it ties into the neurochemical aspects of why willpower doesn't work. And, well, there are some certain states that willpower actually are removed from your brain. When you enter into these states, the first being, of course, when you're hungry. And a lot of this goes back to 12-step programs. They didn't know this when they invented it. It was just kind of one of those divine intervention kind of things that, that seemed to happen. But talk about when you're hungry, you know, you might revert back to old behavior. And, of course, now that we know when you're hungry, of course, your blood sugar drops, which makes you a little bit on edge, and it releases much more neurochemicals, mainly dopamine, so you feel on edge. And so you want to do something to release the serotonin to calm yourself down, and so you're on edge, and so that's why people, you know, don't have good willpower when they're hungry. It's the old, when people are on a diet, everybody does good on a diet till they're hungry. Many substance abusers will tell you when they get really, really physically hungry is when they think about drinking or drugging, because the actual effect of the drink or the drug or even the gambling will be intensified by the hunger state because of the neurochemicals. Also, when you're angry, and anger and fear would be the same kind of physiological state, again, your dopamine serotonin level is out of balance, and so you're looking for a way to sedate that and satisfy it, and so you do something to relieve the anger or the fear, and of course alcohol and drugs will do that. So will food, gambling, sex, whatever your addiction is. Same with when you're lonely or depressed, your dopamine, serotonin levels are out of whack. They're not in balance, and you feel on edge, you feel nervous. And in this case, it's the opposite, where you're too lethargic and laid back. So you do things to try to wake yourself up, to feel better, eat something, smoke a cigarette, drink a beer, play some cards, go do something like that. And, of course, when you're tired, your brain chemicals are out of whack because of the melatonin and getting ready for sleep. Now, when you add those up, it's called HALT. Anybody that's been around 12-step programs have heard HALT, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, and they tell you to halt your behavior and to look at, are any of these things out of whack? So you don't let yourself get too hungry, too angry, too lonely, or too tired, because when you're in those states, you physically have no way to respond to the craving, and it's called the craving brain, where your brain is actually craving something, and you've taught yourself through stimulus response training, if you're an addict, that whatever you're addicted to will be the thing that will sedate that craving in your brain temporarily. And then, of course, usually what happens is there's guilt added to it, and so it exacerbates the negative feeling, which makes the craving even worse, then you're off on a binge. So that's the conscious mind. That's why consciously it's hard to override especially a craving, a strong physical craving. Now, you know, and then we look at the learned behavior, I would say, as we're growing up. Many of us grow up in cultures, depending on where you're at, depending on the addiction you're talking to. I'll talk about alcohol and drugs and food primarily, and smoking. If you grew up in an alcoholic family where you were taught to drink like a man or drink like a woman, depending on your sex, and, you know, real men can handle their liquor, you know, things like that, then, of course, you know, that's all going to come into play, the whole idea of what alcohol is. And if you grew up in a family where all the parties had something to do with drinking, so the idea of, you know, drinking and fun becomes intertwined to the point where you can't imagine having any fun without drinking. And, of course, then you think about not drinking, then you know that, oh, my God, I'm never going to have fun again. So there's that. Same with, like, food. Many of us grew up with the household hearing things like, eat something, you'll feel better. And, of course, now it becomes a learned behavior as well as the physiological response. So it's a two-pronged illness, if not three-pronged, because there's also a spiritual component where, you know, you need to change not just the learned behavior, but the craving response of the brain. Now, a lot of people, there's been an ongoing battle with the psychological community, with some in the psychological and psychiatric community, and I've seen it in the hypnosis and especially in the NLP world, where there seems to be a big clash with the 12-step programs. And I've heard a lot of things. In fact, I just had a talk with somebody the other day, and they had a big problem with labeling yourself. And, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you see somebody that's in recovery, you know, they could be sober, self-disclosed like myself, 24 years. If you ask me, I'd still say, I'm an alcoholic. And you go, well, why do you label yourself? Well, it works for me. But one of the things labeling does is it reminds the person of who and what they are. It's interesting because someone will say that, will say there's no moral judgment on the disease of alcoholism, but I asked that person if they had any relatives that were diabetic, and they said, oh, yeah, they had an aunt that was diabetic. And I said, okay, when was the last time she was in an insulin coma? Well, she'd never been in an insulin coma, and she had it under control. I said, well, then why would she call herself diabetic? If it's under control, you know, then you're not diabetic. You're not in the disease state. And then he goes, well, yes, you are, because it's a physical state as well as a... I said, well, that is exactly what I'm talking about when we come to the why some people find it, you know, and I've heard people say alcoholic, recovering alcoholic, recovered alcoholic. Of course, those of us in NLP know that's all semantics, but we need to find out what it means to them. But anyway, there seems to be this big, a little bit of a conflict with some of that. And also, that, like, why does somebody go to meetings over and over and over again? First, I want to tell you, this is all going to wrap back around to some of the research that found why AA works long term. It's kind of interesting. If a guy is I'll use alcohol or drugs, you know, if a guy, or even an overeater, this would fit. If you spend many hours of your day planning and engineering a way to go get drunk, get high, overeat that day, and then you get into recovery, and now you're not getting high or drinking or overeating or gambling or having indiscriminate sex, what do you do with your spare time? You know, so it's like, what are you going to do? Go home and watch American Idol, you know, Survivor, you know, The Apprentice, one of those things like that. I think, you know, what AA does is fill a social void, because many people, the whole act of the addiction becomes their social support network, whether it's going to the bar to drink or score dope or run around and buy food. It becomes part of your social, or gambling, things like that. It does become somewhat of a social network, albeit a very destructive social network. It is a social network, and human beings are herd or pack animals. So, you know, by going into AA, it helps fulfill some of that need. And it's also interesting that some of us that have been blessed to fall into a profession where we get to actually talk to people about feelings and things that matter, you know, beliefs and values, and help people change and share deep emotional responses with people, it's kind of ironic. Some of those people would say, well, these other people shouldn't be doing that. You know, I always think of my friends where I grew up when guys would work in a steel mill, you know, and so trust me, if you've ever worked in a really blue-collar steel mill, auto plant, iron-working kind of environment, construction site, you're not going to talk to your buddies on the site or in the locker room about, or in the lunchroom about how you're scared because of the economy and, you know, your wife and you aren't getting along, or you're scared for your kids. You just, men or women, you just don't talk that way, especially in that kind of environment. So they go to an AA meeting, and they're encouraged to talk about these things that really matter, feelings, beliefs, values, you know, and these in deep emotional things. So there's a connection there that, you know, if you're not in a church or you're not in some kind of really close-knit family, you have no place to get that, and AA fulfills that. So I always found that kind of ironic. And I think now that some of the research points out that when someone's going to an AA meeting, it's a time that usually takes about an hour, between an hour, hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes, depending on how early they get there and if they stay afterwards. But it's like a time to quiet down. Many of us, and now they know because of some of the things that they've done with the brain chemicals, is that when they're at a meeting, your brain chemistry actually starts to change. You know, part of that could be the social network, because, you know, you get into an AA meeting, a lot of guys there, girls with a lot of sobriety or clean time or recovery from gambling or sex, whatever, or food, whatever the addiction meeting is. And so there's some of that rapport where these people are calm. It helps calm you down. And, of course, we want to be in rapport with people. So if you come in an agitated state, it forces you to sit there and somewhat pay attention to other people. And it's a quiet environment. It's like a quiet time, even if people are talking. And then there's a lot of laughing and joking. And so it actually releases and balances the brain chemistry. It's why you see people that have been in recovery for years, say if they don't go to meetings, you know, a couple of times a week, they miss it, because it's a time for them to balance the neurochemicals of their brain. and it actually balances the dopamine serotonin levels, and so you're calm, and you know, you hear people talk, they go to meetings, they can go home and go to sleep, something they couldn't do before. And so what's interesting about that is it's the same thing that happens when someone practices transcendental meditation. Some of the same kinds of brain chemical changes happen where your brain chemistry seems to stabilize and balance where you feel okay. And it's not that you don't want to drink. It's not that you want to drink. It's like it doesn't matter. And so you don't do the behavior because you're actually balanced in that moment in time. And so long-term psychotherapy will also get, I don't know about the new ones with the brief therapy and the 30-minute sessions, but in the old days when the average session was 45 to 50 minutes, you know, and it was slow and it was very, you take your time and you talk and you do things like that, it forces you to calm down whether you're doing a formal trance or not. Now, for what we do with the NLP and the hypnosis, it hits the same kind of brainwave patterns as you do in meditation. So people calm down, relax. And so what I think is we need to be looking more in this current research of how to balance the brain chemistry and how NLP and hypnosis can speed up this effect and maybe teach some self-regulatory methods to people if they're in a recovery program. So they can, you teach them, you know, what AA might take 2 or 3 years to do on how to, you know, slow down, take a few deep breaths, calm down. Of course, in AA or NA or one of the eight programs they talk about, call your sponsor, call somebody, talk it out, which vents it. You know, we can still encourage that, but we can also encourage them to practice maybe a self-anchoring technique to calm down, to enter into a calm state, and actually imagine the person's brain chemicals going into balance. So, you know, when your dopamine level's too high, you're too agitated. When your serotonin level's too high, you're too lethargic. You need those in balance because you want to be alert and yet calm. That's what most of us talk about. You know, those of us that become hypno-junkies, as most of us are that are in this field, is coming out of a nice hypnotic state. Your brain is actually in balance for that moment, you know, until you start moving and doing some things. And so that's the thing I wanted to stress is that, you know, the hypnosis and NLP, we can be an adjunct to a traditional 12-step program if the person chooses to use that. We can also, you know, whether they can even go into like a religious kind of program. People quit drinking and giving up drugs and alcohol and gambling, sex, and even overeating in a lot of different ways, therapy, hypnosis, religious programs, traditional 12-step programs. I'd say whatever works for the person. But I think we need in our field to be a little bit more sensitive to what a 12-step program really is. It's a network. It's a place where people can feel safe. For many of us, we had to learn how to have fun without drinking and do it in a safe environment. And in the alcohol and drug world, in those recovery programs, they actually, you know, they have parties and dances and cookouts and things like that, so people learn how to have fun again without any threat, without any fear that you know, they're going to be enticed to drink, because at one of the social functions, whether it's a New Year's Eve party or a 4th of July picnic, or like I'll be involved in a couple weeks on a Sunday at a picnic, and you know, it'll be the same thing, volleyball, baseball, the stuff people do outside doing this, and yet no one will be drinking because there'll be none there. So people can learn how to have fun. For those of us that weren't socialized in that way, it's a great thing. So I think we need to be open to it. And also, you know, what happens after the hypnosis or the psychotherapy or whatever it is that you want to call yourself when you're working with people? When those sessions are over, whether it's a few sessions or several sessions, you know, they might need a social support network. They can always come back and see us, but it opens up a different thing. The other thing that we can do with our skills is in all the 12-step programs, there's a step in there where you do a fearless and thorough moral inventory, and then you... that's the fourth step. And then you do the fifth step where you reveal these defects of character to another human being. And many people in the 12-step programs look for professionals, you know, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, alcohol and drug counselors, and I think even us as hypnotists would work as this, where they can reveal this because it gets a load off their consciousness. I've had people come to me, and I've hypnotized them to be more relaxed, where they felt safe enough to reveal some of those secrets, realizing that because they were doing it in a professional environment, I could never, ever tell another human being, because by law, you know, I would lose my license, go to jail, and do all that stuff. And so it's a little safer to tell a licensed professional or even a semi-licensed professional like most hypnotists are, because most of the states and provinces, for my Canadian person on the call, you would be viewed from the law, from a legal standpoint, as a professional if someone came to you and revealed some of these things. And so so that's why I think we should be a little bit more sensitive to the 12-step programs. Not that you have to be an advocate nor an enemy of it, just be open to what it is, and maybe, you know, if you're not familiar with it, read some literature on it and find out what it really is. And it's much different than people think. And I think the last thing I wanted to talk about, and then we'll just take some questions and talk some more open on the call and record it, is, again, the whole thing about how we should start getting into some of the research on how we can use the NLP and the hypnosis and even EFT and things like that to balance some of these brain chemicals. Maybe there's some things that we can do to help speed up the balancing brain chemicals in our clientele, because that's where the craving comes from. It's not a matter of choice. It's about a craving brain. When your brain chemicals are out of whack, you know, it's why when you wake up in the morning, if you're a coffee drinker, you don't have to be an alcoholic or drug addict to relate to this. If you're a coffee drinker, when you wake up, you're craving coffee. Why? Coffee stimulates the dopamine receptors in the brain to make more, so you're more alert. It wakes you up. It is a stimulant, and it wakes you up. If you're not a coffee drinker, of course, you look at, like my wife looks at me, like, why are you having coffee in the morning? Well, she's not a coffee drinker. Her brain doesn't crave it. Trust me, mine does, right? So, I mean, maybe I could attack it from a different viewpoint. And lastly, I will throw in, there's some brilliant research going on about some of the things out, you know, natural cures that also help with these brain chemical things. And the two I'm most familiar with lately, or there's three, is 5-HTP, which is it's a hormone precursor, but your brain uses it to make both dopamine and serotonin. So if you take it in, it seems to curb the craving that people have. Now, what's interesting about that, you can buy 5-HTP dirt cheap, you know, at a health food store, and there were some studies done where it actually has better efficacy than some of the prescription medication that's supposed to help cravings. Of course, we don't hear about that in our country because there's no money in that. The other thing is called taurine, which many people know it as the active ingredient in the sport drinks, like I'm looking at sitting here in front of me. Taurine is the biggest active ingredient because it stimulates the brain chemicals and wakes your brain up, which would help. And then the last is would be another one called tyrosine, which can help speed up the brain chemicals also. These are all just they stimulate neurotransmitters to be made in your brain. Your body needs the building blocks to make these, and these are them, and most of our diets are deficient in that, and could be why certain things are happening that are happening. But, you know, not that, of course, we don't prescribe, as all of our organizations would say, unless that's what you do for a living. We don't prescribe. We don't even recommend. But you might let people know that what these things do is really help take the craving off, because I'll close with a couple of studies I read. One was on smoking, where they gave people the 5-HTP, and they taught them some self-hypnosis techniques. They called them meditation. We'd call them self-hypnosis. Same thing. And they had a better efficacy than the current shots or pills or whatever it is that they're doing now. From the medical standpoint, it actually had better efficacy than going into any kind of stop smoking treatment program. It was just something that simple, because it helped stabilize the brain chemicals. And smoking, of course, nicotine stimulates the brain chemicals. So, and then they used 5-HTP, and it helped sedate the cravings for alcohol. And that was a fascinating study. And again, the colors. and with no side effects because, you know, it's an amino acid. If your body doesn't use it, it just gets rid of it. So those are just some of the current research and, you know, why we can really augment what our clients are doing. And then the last thing, of course I keep saying that, sound like Bill Clinton, the last thing he's notorious to say like eight times in a speech, is we also need to be, there's two of them, and I wanted to talk about, and then we'll take questions, a couple of the fastest growing addictions. One is prescription medication. There's been some commercials here in the States where they, you know, it's a dope dealer all mad because none of the kids are coming to him to buy dope or drugs because they're just going into their parents' and grandparents' medicine cabinet and getting high. There's a lot of information on how to put together certain, even, I don't want to say inert, but certain of the chemicals or, you know, the drugs that people take for health issues, you put them together and then it gets you high. Of course, there are damages that they do, but it's laying around, it's easy to get, and things like that. So there's the over-the-counter or the prescription addictions that people are abusing. The other two that are rapidly growing is gambling, as someone mentioned on the call earlier, because gambling is a growing addiction because of, it seems like every time you turn around, they're opening up a casino somewhere. You know, here in Tampa, they're going to expand a couple of casinos. They're talking about adding river boats and all this other stuff. And they, of course, that's my personal opinion and not to be political, but they say it'll raise money for something, and I never quite figure that out. But so gambling is really going up. And the way gambling is really going up is Internet gambling and kids gambling on college campuses. I just read a little thing that was on, I think, CNN, where they were finding kids coming out of college with massive gambling debts. They still are credit cards. And some of these kids are taking their credit cards and maxing them out gambling. And then, of course, the online gambling games and how, you know, you're supposed to be 18 to get into some of these games or 21. But I remember working with a lady, and she was so proud that her son had won some poker tournament, but they wouldn't give him his prize because they found out he was like 13. And I'm sitting there going, but aren't you upset your kid was playing poker on these things at 13. She said, well, but he won. I said, but what if he's lost? And she said, well, they couldn't have done anything. He's only 13. And to me, that kind of summed up an attitude of compliance of the parents that I see. You know, as long as the kids supposedly are winning, they seem to be supporting it. But anyway, the whole thing about going online and gambling and the chat rooms with gambling and things like that. And then the last is the internet addiction itself. Especially the chat rooms and some of that, because of the social network pages, you know, Facebook, I can't even name them. I'm not even on most of those. I'm a little behind the curve on that. And, you know, people are substituting real relationships for the online thing. And so that seems to be a growing addiction that we'll probably be facing in the next few years. And those of us in this field will probably be the type that people would want to contact about, because they're rather new addictions, especially the internet gambling and the internet addiction itself. I've read some things about it, and I need to do more because it's a different kind of addiction. Especially if you figure if you work in an office where you have to use the internet for work, and so that would be like being a recovering alcoholic that had to run a bar. So I'm not quite sure how to attack that yet. I've only dealt with it once or twice, and so as I come up with ideas or treatments or read about things, I'll let people know. So that's basically all I wanted to go over, especially the stuff on the craving brain and how the research has said that the meditation, hypnosis, altered states training actually biobalances is the term of the brain, and it helps offset what clinical psychology would be called landscape triggers, where, like, you see a bar, hear a clinkling of a glass for an alcoholic. We'd call it anchors in NLP, but it also helps offset that, because when your brain is biobalanced, if you get an anchor going off, or what they'd call a landscape a trigger, it doesn't have the same effect because your brain's in balance, and so it's like, meh, it doesn't agitate it as much as if it was out of balance. And so, and again, if you're not hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, of course that would help, but we can help train people with that. So with that, I think we'll just see if anybody has any questions on anything, and we can and see where this takes us. So, anybody
can you hear?
Questions? Yeah.
I wasn't sure whether it was muted or not. I thought it was interesting on the 5-HTP because that's something that's been used for weight control for a long time. So it's interesting to see that commonality with the other addictions.
Mm-hmm. Well, food is medicating, as anyone's ever had medication to tell you, especially high sugar foods. And so, yeah, thanks for bringing that up because, I used to tell people years ago, take 5-HTP in my weight loss clinic, not just because I read that it worked. I tried it, said, yeah, it seems to help take the craving, and that's what I've heard people say. You know, I know I used to tell people if they had sugar cravings at night, take a 5-HTP in the evening, and it seems to offset it. Plus, it seems to help you sleep better because, again, it's biobalancing your brain. So,
right.
So,
yeah, but this is the first.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, finish.
No, I was just going to say this is the first time I've heard the 5-HTP being used for the other addictions, so it's very interesting. I was wondering if you had heard anything in the research about as these prescription drugs and gambling are going up, are there any decrease in these other addictions? As more people are gravitating to these new ones, are they leaving the old ones behind, or
no? They're just. I think two? Now. More, I think the thing we're running into, and I see it in the 12-step programs because I'm still involved, are dual addictions or poly addictions. You know.
Okay.
It's hard to run into somebody that's trying to come off alcohol that doesn't at least didn't occasionally get high.
Okay.
You know, or use some kind of mood-altering chemical. And, you know, of course, now they finally started to talk about, in some of the treatment centers, they're suggesting people don't gamble. Because I'd seen people sober up. Okay, they're not drinking or drugging, but they're, you know, they're playing cards till 4 in the morning. So
then we talk about an addictive personality then, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, like, at most of the treatment centers, they used to, of course, there's not treatment centers like there used to be. Used to be, you needed help, you actually had places to go. Now they say, just say no, and good luck to you.
Right.
But the in the treatment centers, they started only serving decaf coffee, right, which kind of makes sense. I mean, person's coming off alcohol or drugs, and you know you don't need them drinking 25 cups of coffee and then saying I can't sleep.
Right.
So they,
give me something to sleep.
And what was fascinating, I think the first treatment center that did it that proved that it worked. By the way, for years the treatment centers fought the getting people to stop smoking. You know, if you went into alcohol treatment, they didn't care if you smoked. In fact, most of the hospitals. The last place in the hospital you could smoke was the alcohol and drug treatment center, if they had one. I know the VA was like that. I mean, the whole facility went smoke-free, but you could still smoke in the alcohol treatment. But the Hazleton was the first, I think, and then probably Betty Ford, and now that pretty much across the board. They went, when you check in to get off alcohol or drugs, you can't smoke. And, of course, there was a big fear that there would... it wouldn't work, and it would cause all these problems. When in effect, it was counterintuitive. It actually was easier for people because it was the old. It actually got them clean and sober. You know. Now, did they stay smoke free? I don't know. I didn't read. I didn't follow up on it, and no one really did because, of course, once people leave the program, you know, how are you going to check that if they start going to meetings? You know, people still stand outside and smoke, but, of course, in our culture here and in most places in Canada, you know, you can't smoke in the public buildings anyway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So meetings are considered public spaces now, so people have to stand outside and smoke, but they actually did that. So that was just kind of interesting.
Yeah.
The other addiction, you know, that I've always had personally that's I've dealt with probably 35 or 40 cases, none in the last couple of years, or last year, but probably 10 years before that, was pornography. And that was an addiction that, that's another one that's, excuse the pun, is under the table, that no one wants to face up to, you know. Because right now I still think that of all the money made on the internet, pornography makes more than anything. And so obviously it's there. And the internet has changed the pornography addiction. And here's a story just to say how addicts can be kind of strange in their own world. I treated a guy who was a porn addict, but back in the... He was a porn addict in the 80s and 90s, and he was also an alcohol and drug addict, so I knew him from something else, and then he came to see me, and we worked on some issues, and it worked, and he got active in what they call Sex Addicts Anonymous for the pornography. But what he said was interesting, because I saw this in AA, where some of the old-time people from alcohol couldn't relate to the younger people coming in that also did drugs. This guy, he said that, you know, the sex addict meetings, especially for the pornography, he couldn't relate to people that were porn addicts from the internet, because, you know, you sit in front of the computer for hours at a time, checking this website, checking that website, chat rooms, all the, you know, all the, I don't know what they all are, but whatever they are, there are, but you don't have to leave your house, you know. And he was talking about how, you know, when he was a porn addict, you know, he had to
back in the good old days.
Yeah, you know, you were a real man. You had to sneak into the bad part of town, yeah.
God.
Yeah, you and Pee Wee Herman, yeah, you know, that kind of stuff. So it was just kind of interesting, but, you know, but I will say the one thing I noticed is the one variable I found, and this was none, and I'm not saying this is official, and I'm not saying anything other than an anecdotal experience on mine, but one of the strong variables for a pornography addiction was rigid religious upbringing, and being in being active in a strict religious church.
Why would that be so?
I think because it becomes a self punishment as well as a self gratification. You know, and the other thing that people, if you've never dealt with porn addicts, and I just give you insight because it took me a while to figure this one out. What I couldn't understand, some guy was talking to me once about how he spent like all weekend, but like two 10-hour days, like, or not even that, 15-hour days on Saturday and Sunday, going to all these like porn shops and doing this and playing online and doing this. I mean, he's off on a porn binge, right? So I was working with him, we're talking about it. So I make the comment, because I didn't know, it wasn't an addiction I had, so I did not know. So I asked honestly, I said, well, how many times have you had orgasms on that weekend?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, none. It would have stopped the experience. So it wasn't about having an orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's always a few, yeah, they can have, you know, but most of them, it's like, and then I dealt with another guy who had a different kind of, it was a sex addiction, where it was a gay man who went to a lot of the gay bathhouses, and he was talking about how, you know, he'd be in there and meet somebody, and they would hook up and start doing something, and then, you know, whatever, 5-10 minutes, just stop, take a break, leave, and walk around to find somebody else. Because it's about the experience. It wasn't about an orgasm. And then I did talk to some people who dealt with pornography addictions, and they were saying, oh, yeah, that's the big part you have to, as the treater, you have to begin to understand. So just some share something with you that surprised me, and I'm, I, I'm not usually surprised.
I have a question with regard to getting back to hypnosis and meditation, leveling out the brain.
Uh-huh.
What about using binaural beats? Has that been thought about?
I don't know if it's been tested, to be honest. I was just, I was looking for the book before I got on the call, and I apologize. It's called The Craving Brain. He talks about some of the research, and then there's more research out there. But I imagine it would do the same. I don't know, but I would, because I know, like, the brainwave patterns, the binaural beats with the brainwave synchronizer glasses, zoned out. Yeah. So I hope we could, maybe one day there'll be a study on it.
Hmm.
Maybe you know somebody that could do the study, but, you know, you got to have access to an MRI machine.
Yeah, the MRI is a little bit difficult to get hold of.
Yeah, and you need the kind that you can sit up when you're doing it, too. So. Yeah.
Well, they're all kinds.
They're finding out more and more, I'm telling you. It's fascinating stuff.
Well, there's all kinds of binaural beat programs, perfect meditation, HoloSync, NeuroProgrammer 2 has programs to create binaural beats. Anybody who's in the hypnosis NLP business, if they want to use or create CDs that have binaural beats, if they get this program, Neural Programmer 2, it's quite easy to do that on your own.
Oh, okay.
I'm fairly familiar with the because I've been using the HoloSync program now going on about 3.5 years.
Oh, okay.
So, and I've found that it was quite helpful for me in ending some addictions that I had. Won't say what they were. But
oh, okay.
Get on addicted to food, it would be great, though. But food is a different kind of a thing, though, in the sense that you have to eat at some point.
Yeah, you got to open Pandora's box at least 3 times a day.
Yeah, you know, so yeah. It's a different kind of addiction than alcohol, where it's not something that your body requires.
Right. Yeah, you can live the rest of your life never have a drink of alcohol, smoke a cigarette, or use drugs, but you got to eat. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Any other questions or comments?
No, I'm good.
I'm too.
All right. Well, hopefully, I think over this next weekend or next week, I'll have these up on the podcast so people can link to them and listen to them again. And
great.
Cool.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you very much.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you, and I better find my instructions so I make sure I don't mess it up. So I'd like to thank you all for joining me, and, you know, if you have any questions on anything, email me. What else was I going to say? I think that was it. And if you use anything as you find out information, here's what I was going to say. Please email me so we can put it in the e-zine and up on the website to make it more of a user accessible. Because I keep encouraging everybody, it's not just stuff I find. I want other people to put their stuff up there, too. So,
right.
So if you get info and you let me know, write it up, get it to me, we'll put it up on the website or in the e-zine and get it out. So,
okay.
Everyone, have a good night.
Okay, you too. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Bye-bye.
This conference is no longer being recorded.